Well, hello and welcome to the first episode of Bite Fix Podcasts, a new series of podcasts looking at match fixing in sport, during which we'll speak to a number of experts and stakeholders in this area. The Bite Fix project is funded by the European Union's Erasmus Plus programme and is set up to assist sports organisations, governments, regulators and other key stakeholders in the fight against match fixing by creating innovative tools to impart knowledge. This series of podcasts being a key aspect of that. My name is Andrew James. I've been a sports journalist and broadcaster across newspapers, radio and television for over 40 years. I've worked for the BBC since 1990, and I also include global broadcasters like TNT and IMG amongst my clients. My guest today is Moses Swebu, who made over 150 appearances in English football before being sentenced to 16 months in prison for his part in a match-fixing scandal 10 years ago. Moses set up workshops whilst in prison to persuade others not to make the same mistake, and he now works with young footballers, indeed footballers of any age, delivering his message, which he's going to share with us here. Thank you very much, Moses, for accepting our invitation today. It's never widely reported, but there is, in fact, no shortage of football match fixing and suspected football match fixing stories in the news. If you go looking for them, just lately, there have been reports about match fixing investigations in Fiji, Nigeria, Belarus and Namibia, to name just a few of them that we've seen come to light. And of course, there have been much higher profile cases over the years in Spain, Portugal, Germany, Italy, Turkey, Greece as well. So Moses, I think my first question to you is, for me as a football fan for many years, you almost think it's impossible to fix a football match, because if one player does something, then another player who's not in on it could do something else that prevents a goal or prevents a booking or something. So give us an idea, if you would, just about how football fixing works.
Yeah, thank you for having me, guys. I really appreciate the call and you guys reaching out to get my experiences as well as hearing me on this podcast. I think to answer your question, Andrew, there's various different strands of match fixing. I believe from my first conception of it, or my first introduction to match fixing, just like many football fans and probably 80 to 90% of other people in sport and outside of sport, I actually didn't know what it was. So, you know, there wasn't any education around match fixing. You know, I came from a generation where the money in football wasn't where it is today. And, you know, as any young boy and girl growing up in society now all across the world, you don't think about how much money you're going to make. You play the sport to come out of your communities, come out of tough situations, family life, cultural differences, demographics and backgrounds. So as a young boy, I'd say it was very hard for me to channel my thoughts and have the right support networks and the right role models around me, because I grew up in inner London, probably at a time where there wasn't any social media or there wasn't any, you know, their presence. So if you had to go out and play with your friends, the only way you can get your friends out of your house is if you take a football or you take a microphone or you try and do something creative. And there was plenty more youth clubs and everything around there. So fast forwarding to actually answer your question, my very much first introduction from match fixing came from a senior professional, obviously Delroy Facey. How it worked at the time, when I was first contacted, they simply wanted us to concede two goals in the first half. Now, I'm someone, even now, I've never really gambled or betted, even. I'm 34 years old, but never been into bookies or anything. So it was very direct and stringent. This is what I want you guys to do. This is how you're going to do it. And this is how you're going to get paid. So many years later, if I can kind of bring us all up to speed, the second time round, because I'd seen that first approach within a 4-year period, I already knew that in football, it does happen. And when I mean it does happen, I saw, you know, around €60,000 when I was a 19-year-old teenager, earning probably £1,000 a week at Lincoln City. And that's the most money I'd seen. So I knew the severity of what actions would have been taken. But then again, I didn't know, A, what my teammate was up to, and B, I didn't know the individual, what they were capable of doing. So part of me made me realise that, you know, how do you even fix a match? There was four players present in that hotel room. One played up front, one played in midfield, one played at the back. So automatically it allowed me to understand that, okay, maybe you need a spine of a team to, you know, predict the score of an outcome. But again, to many athletes across the world now, it's very hard going out on a pitch or playing field or professional or amateur sport, knowing that you've been asked the question. And if you do go ahead with it, there's almost this niggling gut feeling, almost like butterflies you get, knowing that any time, what happens if you get caught? And again, following on from your question, just to give you wider context, the second time around it happened, I had a 4-year period of space and thinking process, and I was getting a lot older with circumstances changing for me to understand exactly how it works.
And in the dressing room, I mean, again, it must have been such a stressful time for you, because you were going into matches with that agenda, knowing that it had to be 2 goals first half, 2 goals second. But you can't legislate for what other players do around you. The goalkeeper might have pulled off a fantastic save or something like that. So it must have really sort of completely taken your mind away from focusing on the game to focusing on what you knew you had to do for the fixers.
Yeah, so if I can kind of give you more context and understanding to the audience, if we take it back, match fixing isn't just as simple as go and lose 1 or 2-0. You know, whilst you're dealing with high-level organised crime, you have to remember on the other side of the fence, an illegal gambling and betting side on a black market, these guys have been in this industry for 30, 40, 50 years. And the types of money that they're gambling and the types of liquidity that they're creating and the amount of people that are actually infected by what they're doing reaches hundreds of millions globally, all across the world. So it sounds easy saying, OK, well, we just need you to lose 2-0. But then again, to answer your first and your second question, I quickly understood how the Asian betting handicap market worked. And on that market, you can literally bet on anything. So to give you an example, a player can get approached and say, you know, we only want you to get a yellow card. But then again, if you're a defensive midfielder and over the course of your career, you've got significant yellow and red cards, how are you going to tell whether that person's match fixing or not? Or I'll give you another example. If you approach a goalkeeper at the end of the season, he's kept several clean sheets. He's probably been the best player in the season. But then again, in lower level amateur football, you're not paid throughout the summer. And he may turn around and say, OK, well, I want to earn X amount for this game so I can go on holiday. How can you pinpoint or penalise whether that person's match fixing or not, if that makes sense?
Yeah, yeah. No, exactly. Yeah. And you touched on the betting aspect and those. And the amount of money that football accepts from betting companies and front of shirt sponsorships and things like that when there is all this going on. But match fixing isn't purely about the betting syndicates, is it? There are other reasons why fixers get involved.
Yeah, and you know, again, why I believe my story is quite unique. From 2009, between 2013, I knew the, how can I put this? I knew how dangerous sponsorship would be. So again, when you get into any type of crime or organized crime, as I should say, maybe naively, a lot of things stem from, okay, it may just be as simple as getting paid for the week. And a lot of people didn't realize at the time, my girlfriend was heavily pregnant. The club had not paid me for 4.5 months. When I was approached by the second syndicate, I had a week to make a decision. And I sent a text message to my managers and asking them, almost pleading for help, which I've still got to this day. And I asked him, Gaffer, you know, I'm having a tough time at the moment. Can I take time off to, you know, stay at home with my family and look after my child when she's born? He turned around and he said, if you do that, you're going to have to accept a fine. And the reason why I'm saying this, and it's so important, mentally, as a young professional or a young athlete, there's so much psychological decisions you have to make. Now imagine having no father figure, no positive male role models, your parents ain't at home. You're now an age where financially you take care of your family. Off the back of that, you now have these new friends, if I should call them that. that turn around and say things like, well, you don't even have to fix a match, but here, take a few thousand pounds because you haven't been paid. And whilst they do that, it's almost like a law for you to say, okay, let me do it once. And then the more it happens, this is where greed comes into it. The more greed comes into it, this is where gambling and addiction come to it. The more you're intertwined with the syndicate, and again, coming back to your question, I knew that these guys were able to use betting companies, and you can call it anything. So let's call it one bet one. They can go to a non-league club, promote that betting company, provide a liquidity from their criminal activity. There wasn't any checks around that time. Send players who were match fixing on trial to these clubs to, you know, almost be data scouts. Off the back of that, make the right people in business speak to the clubs. A lot of students in and around the UK that were from the Far East that can articulate themselves from business and sport and credentials can speak to these clubs. Then before you know it, 1X Bet One sponsors a team in the conference. Now, you don't know where that company is situated because it's just a logo and a shirt. But what that does is fuel massive amounts of money to make sure that the criminality grows and more players at that team and at that level, because they played low, can be incentivized to, if there's 42 games in the season, all you need to do is fix one. That can pay your wages for 5 years, you know, if you do it, if you go ahead and do it and it happens. And I knew that when I was, 23? Off the back of me knowing that when I was 23, I remember before I went to prison and a lot of questions came into my head. Hold on a minute. What happens if betting grows? You know, the internet's growing, digitalization growing. What happens if young people and their games are bet on? What happens in academy football if these players are approached? Because whilst I have my story, what always stuck in the back of my mind, I've had quite a hard upbringing and a hard life. So I was hardened in a way. But then again, not everybody's like me. So one example, Michael Boateng didn't actually fix any matches. He's turned up to a meeting, never been arrested by the police, A-star student. Me and him are in contact. He's got caught up in a conspiracy. He goes to prison. He comes out of prison. He goes back to prison for selling drugs. These are things that people need to understand when across the world. So you mentioned all of these countries. And geographically, I don't know what happens in Malta, in Brazil, in Africa, in Asia, because it's very much different when you're growing up in London. So when these people approach you, again, Andrew, you know, I was in a position, if I'm going to be really open and honest in this podcast, before I went to prison, you know, prison saved my life because I was able to see what they're doing, how they're doing it, understand how their business works, where their business works, how money's laundered, how they bet, how they gamble, how they leverage it on other sports. And a question was asked for me at a time, do you want to go into Europe? You know, I'd retired at 24 because, you know, it felt like almost like some form of death. I couldn't physically walk on the pitch. And most importantly, again, to answer your question, match fixing, you don't actually have to match fix. It's the organized crime and the elements of being a part of that syndicate and that business in various different areas. There were players that were sent out to go and trials to football clubs just to give back information. When we look at match fixing, you have insider information.
Lost him for a second.
With you, Moses. So you were saying that some players went to other clubs on trial just to bring back information.
Yeah, so, you know, again, how does a business work? You have different departments and different people doing different things, and there was no difference with these guys. You can almost imagine in that time, how does one person control half of a league? You know, there's 20 teams in a league, 10 teams are corrupt. Over 50 players had been incentivized over a season to go and do various different things. And part of that is really unfortunate because how are you even able to investigate that, you know?
Do you think, Moses, that football is its own worst enemy really here? Because it strikes me there's almost a feeling that it's a victimless crime, because people, I'm not saying this is the right view in all my view, but people might say, well, footballers earn a lot of money. There's a lot of money swilling around in football. The FA is one of the richest governing bodies around. UEFA and FIFA, obviously, likewise. And the things you're describing in any other walk of life would be things around perhaps people trafficking, around sexual exploitation, grooming, things like that. What you were saying about how you were asked to do things. And yet there doesn't seem to be the same kind of interest in dealing with it as there is in those other areas.
But Andrew, you know, I think what we need to widen our thought processes and what we take in is the fact that how much money does illegal gambling make, you know? And when you look at that, that fuels other crimes. And the reason why I know that, I've seen it with my own eyes. So what I went to prison for was conspiracy to commit bribery. But then again, what I experienced was completely something different. You know, I probably saw things I didn't want to see, and I met people that I didn't want to meet. And part of that, and some form of savior or saving, not only for football, because we have to take into consideration if it's a Saturday, Formula One can be on, you know, tennis can be on, snooker can be on. There's a lot of events that happen on, you know, any betting market. And they're able to leverage that market by putting on multiple bets, by using certain, you know, Asian handicaps in order to generate that. We look at, you know, data, which is very important. And again, if we go back 10 years, I knew that there were people recording games and making sure the bets lag over in countries across Europe and Asia where there may be a 1 or 2 minute delay. So if a goal goes in, how are they going to know on the other end in non-league football or low-level sport what's actually happening? So everything's always maximizing. You know, if you look at the amounts now in a digitalized era, you have cryptocurrency, you have digital banking, you have Apple Pay. So how are these players even approached? You know, how are these athletes even approached? And it's very hard, from what I know now, how do you even investigate this if there's no actual laws or frameworks to severity of punishments being put in place?
And from your work that you're doing, and we'll come on to that, going into clubs, talking to young players who are in that same situation, because it's a very small percentage, isn't it, of players that actually make it from academies and things like that into the professional game to play. We'll come on to that in a moment. But from your experience of what governing bodies are doing and what police authorities, Interpol, government, who needs to be doing more? In your opinion, Moses, who needs to be doing more in order to start tackling this?
I can probably give you the best example of that question. So if we look at governing bodies and everyone in this space, you have, I think, the law and the judicial system. You have police forces. You have governing bodies, football clubs. You have lotteries, betting and gambling companies, and you have data companies. Out of the seven I've just mentioned, nothing's actually centered around the athlete. And this is where I believe I come into it or try and expand on that, because everybody has jobs. And whilst everybody is doing their jobs, we have to take into consideration, again, people have families to feed, people have livelihoods. And more importantly, like anything, unless it actually happens to you, you're never really going to know the depth of what's actually happening on a day-to-day basis. The difference between athletes is athletes are not the people that make the decisions. It's the people in business in sport that make the decisions. And that provides a significant disconnect, because if we look at the law and police, especially amongst athletes and sports, and this is where my training comes into it, there's already a stigma around not telling, whistleblowing, coming forward. So the peer pressure that athletes are put on, and again, why I can resonate, I wish I could have gone to someone at Lincoln City or Chris Sutton and said, hey, Gaffer, I've just been approached by the captain to go and fix a match. Now, the manager has a difficult job because two things can happen. He can, you know, try and help and speak, but he needs to report that. If he reports that, he runs the risk of that going out in the public. If that goes out in the public, there's an investigation. Where he probably loses his career, and I knew that. So you can almost imagine at a high level where players are making hundreds of thousands of pounds a week, they may not match fix, but they're going to gamble. And I know when they do go and gamble, where they're gambling, in casinos. And who owns these casinos? You know, and who operates these casinos and where these operators are? So if you live in London and you're out in the town and you've gone to the races, you're more prone to an approach by a match fixer without you knowing than someone who's just got released from a club, because the entry levels are different. And whilst you have gambling and addiction, and one thing you'll find, Andrew, there is a lot of companies and people providing education. Prime example, Ivan Tony. He's had 3 sessions with Epic Risk, but he's still gone and gambled and, you know, broken laws. And the reason why I say, not to, you know, kind of throw Epic under the bus, but I'd like to know, how do you understand Ivan before you give him the training? You know, how do you get into these players' heads? How do you make sure that you have the right compelling videos and initiatives and education where they're really interactive, rather than just stand there for an hour, 365 days isn't enough. You know, how do you provide robust programs for elite athletes and sports professionals? Because for Ivan to go and, you know, break the laws, there needs to be something done in training. And if there isn't something done in training, we need to almost marry all of the 7 actors into one and say, okay, whether it's tennis, whether it's football, whether it's cricket, guess what? The matrixes don't discriminate against sport. You know, they can use all of those sports and just bet onto one pot. So surely everybody should be working in some capacity to, you know, if they are going to provide this level of education, it can be done, Andrew, but it's just how that's done. And rather than, you know, institutions and governing bodies waste tens of millions of pounds on systems that they believe should happen, what happens when these athletes don't respond to it, you know?
It's like a box ticking for them sometimes, isn't it? And as you say, the athletes aren't actually benefiting from it. I mean, I was going to ask you, Moses, what does a typical match fixer look like? But, you know, I've been around football grounds a long time. I covered Nottingham Forest in Brian Clough's time. And you often saw people in the car park thinking, well, they're talking to players as they're coming out after training. And you just assume they've gone to valet the car or whatever it might be. But I'm getting the impression from you that, you know, we are talking far more about serious organised crime than just the local, you know, the local rascal who's, you know, trying to earn a few bob sort of thing.
Yeah, you know, it's a great question you present, because I'm still quite amazed at the fact that you'll never know unless you know them. And these people in organised crime are able to blend into society, and they have structures in place to allow other people to run their operations, not their business, in various different elements and areas of the world. And if you look at data, which is so significant, and I mention this quite a lot, a matrixum knows more about you as an athlete than you know about yourself. When I was approached, they knew how many games I'd played, where I lived, how, you know, who my friends were, you know, where I operate. And this is why social media can be a deterrent, which is quite dangerous. You know, a lot of athletes post plenty of pictures and videos, but it isn't hard to find out if I see a background where that player or that person is. And if we want to go a bit deeper into how they look like, they're just normal people walking in the street, you know. And again, to come to what happened with Michael when he was approached by match fixers, I asked Michael when he went to that meeting, how does that person look like? And it wasn't what I know match fixers look like. Then I already knew, Michael, to be honest, something's up, because that's not normal. But that comes obviously with experience, and more importantly, I've probably met a few match fixers of different backgrounds and races. And the ones that are in and around the organised crime group are people that have come into the system that have obviously been corrupted. You mentioned players getting released, or there's a 95%+ of players getting released. If you're not at a top tier academy, where do you think they're going? They don't go up, they don't go in Europe, they go down the pyramid. They go to step 4, step 5, step 6, step 7, step 8. Then before you know it, clubs are still not paying players the way they should be paid. In the pandemic, clubs put on a wage cap. That always increases approaches to how match fixers are so sophisticated now. They can approach you online. And if they don't approach you online, you can be out with a partner, or you can be out with a girlfriend or a friend. Someone sits down next to you and says, hey, can I take a picture? Or, you know, I'm a fan. Before you know it, you may be in a casino, or you may be gambling. Or you may go into the training ground and you may talk about what's happened. Then you may turn around and tell another teammate who tells another teammate. And before you know it, 30 to 40 different players understand and know that there's a significant amount being put on the last game of the season. Or if I'm 18 and I get released from a football club, if I'm 35 and I get released from a football club, they're two different things. So you have much more motivation at the end of your career rather than the beginning of your career. So someone at the end of their career will get paid more match fixing than someone at the beginning of their career because they'll always go back.
Is the problem, Moses, getting worse, would you say? I know you said that the COVID outbreak caused a lot of problems with clubs, even at National League Tier 5 level, clubs not having income and players not getting wages. That obviously created a bit of an issue then. Has that carried on? Is it worse now than it was a few years ago, would you say?
I'll actually say the opposite. I think now, because of awareness, you have to remember we're living in a generation of the internet and data. So a lot of governing bodies like UEFA, FIFA, the Premier League especially, everyone is getting better. But, you know, it's still very much an immature market and industry where when you look at education, a lot of people are doing ad hoc ticking box exercises. So if I'm a data company, it isn't actually our business to go and, you know, educate players. We need the data. So we need the licensing agreements from a Premier League or UEFA or FIFA or wherever it may be. Then we can turn around and say, okay, let's just give them an hour's education. So we need to go beyond that and say we need to focus on making sure integrity is such an important word that a lot of people in sport, and especially athletes, don't understand. Fairness, community. You mentioned earlier on in the podcast, you've been a Nottingham fan. Imagine going to watch a team that you love and you adore through generations, knowing that that team's corrupted or players are, producing the scores and outcomes of games because they didn't have the confidence to turn around and say. And I think the responsibility needs to be put on the people that can make these decisions, because ultimately they are getting better because they're identifying it a lot quicker. But then again, there's not enough implementation and impactful effectiveness because, you know, you look at the World Cup, for example, how many teams are outside of Europe? You know, how many players are on next to nothing when it comes to money? So we play football for opportunities. You know, football's a community. It's a global game. It's almost like a religion. So you can almost imagine the officers that work at the FA, the Dutch FA, the Portuguese FA, the biggest issue I see they have is they have to do anti-racism, diversity training. They have around 6 or 7 different jobs. Then they have to do match fixing and anti-corruption and integrity work. So how can one person be bogged down with so much when we're all humans? You know, you still have to go home to your family. You still have to be able to investigate. So when players are caught, you know, and they have their phones over, how long does it take law enforcement to actually investigate it? Then how long does it take, you know, the criminal justice system to actually go and get, you know, convictions? Then when you go back to what you said earlier, you now see it very much as a white collar crime. If I'm going to be really open with you, Andrew, before I even went to jail and the first time we accepted a bribe and money, the first thing I Googled, can you go to prison for match fixing? And there wasn't any laws in the UK. And whilst there weren't any laws, I was training twice a week. Then I Googled it again. Can you go to prison for match fixing? Then when I went on news on Google, I didn't really see a lot globally, and I thought to myself, well, this is strange. And almost now, there's hundreds of players that, at the time, match fixing, they got away with it. These players are still in the system. So it's very hard to keep an eye on everything. But then again, I do believe, to answer your question again, a lot of the governing bodies, football clubs, and the wider sport, you know, tennis is a prime example with their integrity units and what they're doing. So a lot's happening that is doing well.
We've got about 5 minutes left, Moses. Let me just fire a couple of questions to you, if I may. One of the first persons to meet you when you came from prison, you served 4 months behind bars and then you were released and you had the tag and you'd done good work there, and as you obviously carried that on. But I think one of the first people that spoke to you was Gordon Taylor from the PFA, is that right? And is that, have they done enough? Have FIFPro on an international scale, have the players' unions are there to protect players, aren't they? When you're looking around for somebody like me, looking around saying, well, who should be protecting Moses? Moses didn't have that. He's having to do it himself. Who should be protecting him? You look to players' unions, surely. Are they doing enough?
Yeah, you know what? I was actually quite surprised, Andrew, because when match fixing was going on, I remember I actually contacted the PFA And I told them, but guess what? No one understood what I was talking about because they've never seen it happen. So now I left it alone. And when I came out of prison and Gordon got in contact with me, I was like, why would the PFA's chairman come and speak to me? But then I quickly realized the severity of what's actually happened and what they actually know. And he mentioned one thing, which is, how do we stop this happening? And I remember I sat down with the PFA and the FA for 6 months, helping them design what a workshop will be for players. I done a video with them, and you know, that really changed my overview and outlook when I went into Manchester United the first time. And players that now play for England asked me things that I was never aware of, you know. So they asked me about my story, and I said to myself, how can Premier League internationals not know about this stuff? And if that's happening at the Premier League, imagine what else is happening around the world. So yeah, the PFA were very significant to actually help him. But then again, if I am going to be honest, they helped at the reactive time rather than the proactive time.
Understood. And prison must have been so tough. You talked about that first night, and I think you turned to Delroy, who was in a cell with you, and sort of said, what have we done? And you've also referred to your young daughter coming to see you and sort of saying, come on, Daddy, let's go home. I mean, the message really, I guess, has to be that it's just not worth it. You know, that £1,000 that helps you pay the mortgage, it isn't worth it. Is that the message you're giving to people?
I'll go as far as saying, any type of money that doesn't come with hard work, dedication, drive, passion, is significantly wrong. You know, I was a professional athlete that had the opportunity to potentially play in the Premier League. Why am I in prison? What made it worse and what really stuck the knife in? I looked to my left and right, and I had a former Premier League player, a brother that I looked up to, that, you know, allowed me to see this world that I didn't want to see. So on top of that, I've had to leave my cell and then go see my daughter. This all happened within the space of a few hours. So the realization, what I say to people is, that is worst case scenario. And in any worst case scenario, we need to understand that I'm just the version of someone that's actually come out publicly and stuck by what I've said. There's probably hundreds of thousands of athletes across the world that are going through the same thing. And they need to understand that if you do want to take a bribe or take money, think about your family. But most importantly, think about the reasons why you play sport. And especially think about the fans. You know, I still watch football now. And football, my last game I ever played, I wasn't in my body, you know. I couldn't even look players in the eyes. I couldn't look my manager in the eyes. So no amount of money could ever make me feel like that again, you know. That's the message I'll try and get across to other athletes as well.
It's a message you get over very well. Last one, Moses. It's a massive thing now. It's a big contest, isn't it? Who wins, the match fixers, the organised crime gangs, or the sport and people like yourself? Just looking ahead for the next sort of 3 or 4 years, if we can, what do you think, what would you like to see to help you on this, I was going to say crusade. It's not a crusade, is it? You're doing what's coming from your heart. But what would you like to see happen that will mean that we perhaps aren't talking so much about match fixing 5 years down the line?
Yeah, I think, you know, an athlete-led reform, you know, as much as I can put the onus on the people that make decisions, at the end of the day, it's the players that have the choices. And whilst these athletes have the choices, you need to understand law enforcement, governing bodies, police, data companies, everybody, we're all trying to help you. And it's taken me to go to that other side to make me realise, oh, wow, we're all humans, you know. I went to the European Council, I sat down in front of attorney generals and judges all across Europe, and we went out for dinner and we had a conversation like I was having conversations with my friends. So it's so, so important to know that we're here to help. And what I'd like to see that's currently happening now, the majority of these organisations across the board, from football clubs all the way up until the European Council and bodies, absolutely everybody is trying to win the fight to prevent match fixing. And and this is another thing. People always ask me, am I scared of these match fixers? How can you be scared of cowards? That's what they are. Don't think about the millions and the billions or what they're doing. These people are minute, tiny people that hide. And the reason why they hide is because they don't want to be caught. And the reason why they don't want to be caught, they're cheaters. You know, and cheaters shouldn't prosper. Sorry, and more importantly, eventually they'll receive the real brunt of the law. And I have confidence in that, because whilst we look towards a World Cup and we look towards Paris 2024 and other committees, everybody's trying to help and for them. So don't be afraid of these people.
Moses, thank you so much for your time. Everybody at Bitefix Podcast is delighted that you've taken this opportunity to talk to us. And we hope that people listening to us, our audience, which includes many of those people you've spoken about there, will take on what you've said, and things will get better. Moses, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you so much, Andrew. Thank you, guys.